Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets, where record highs were set again this week, and there was also some nice action with gold and silver. Ross also has a special offer for our listeners. Publisher of the Leibovitt VR newsletters, Mark Leibovitt discusses a new 24-hour trading platform, the outlook for copper, and whether there's a meltdown in cryptocurrency. He, too, has a special offer for you. Publisher of the trendletter.com, Martin Straith, takes a look at what's driving the markets higher and talks about currencies, uranium, and energy. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be back with you, Jim.
Ross, do you have a special offer for our listeners?
Yeah, for new subscribers, the ones who want to come on board, we've got a 25% special as far as the annual subscription is concerned. Or if they want to do just a test run, they can come on and get a two-month trial and take a look and see what they see if, in terms of the service and whether they like it. And then they can put that towards the annual annual subscription.
Ross, even though we had two major holidays this past week, the stock market didn't seem to pay attention.
No, the stock market likes holidays, you know, historically. And, you know, the Fosbach book back in the 1970s, and then a lot of research I did with Dr. Bill Zimba in the late 70s, early 80s, we took a look at the holiday stretches and, you know, the turn of the month trades. And historically, the action around holidays is better, way better than average. So when you've got like a July 1st for Canada, a July 4th for the U.S., you're going to expect to see some strength. And July, and when you look back on it, we know what the seasonals are coming out of the fall, where you get that best buy it late in October, early November for the rally into the spring. Well, the next big seasonal run is the one in July. Typically, end of June, you start to base out. You have the strength through the first holiday week there, as we've had now. You can get a bit of a pause shortly after, but it typically likes to run through the end of July and then settle back again in August. And I guess the key question will be, does it become overextended enough that August is a deep break, or is it just going to be a, you know, a pullback? One thing I've been keeping an eye on, you know, I do my big hundred-year chart, and we were up against the top end of the channel on the S&P. That's in that 5,400 to 5,600 range. And this week, you know, we're at 5,500 and change. So we're up into the top end of the channel. The other thing is that if you take a look at the 17-year cycle, that is due to top out this year. Next year would be typically a down year. And strength that you see in this 17th year where we are on the cycle right now, what you want to watch for is to see, as long as the markets continue to stair-step their way higher, So if you take a look at the S&P, you know, we bottomed out here in April, made that nice turn in May. And since then, you've had two minor pullbacks, and this week we broke out to new highs. So what you want to make sure is that you don't come back and overlap the breakouts. If you do and you've lost momentum, the probability is that we could be right back down and testing those April lows again. So you want to keep reasonably tight stops. And, you know, there's no question that the leadership here has been in, you know, a small group of stocks. There's been a little bit of rotation, but it's not huge. But the fact is that when you look at the capitalization-weighted indices like the S&P or the NASDAQ, they are just screaming along. You've had, 20% year so far in the NASDAQ, 16% in the S&P. But if you take a look at the equal-weighted versions of those indices, the S&P is only up 4%. The equal-weighted NASDAQ is up 7%. So it's just a third of what you've seen with the big cap names. You know, if you look at Canada, TSX is up 5% on the year. So it's, you know, it's an uptrend, but it's not got the momentum that we've seen in these IT stocks, in particular, you know, anything in AI.
What's going on with gold and silver?
Finally seeing some action. We had been looking for the gold and silver to have some pressure in through the latter part of June because of the cycles that we're watching in the U.S. dollar index. So the dollar index cycle was due to top out here end of June, first week or so of July. And when the dollar rolls over, then when you take a look at items priced in U.S. dollars, like the precious metals, for at least North American investors, we're looking at them in U.S. dollars. The fact is that those metals tend to come to life. And if you take a look at how prices on the gold and silver did in the 4 weeks that we were in the bullish phase for the U.S. dollar index, the metals just held their own very, very well. So this week, the dollar index started to come under a bit of pressure, down marginally on the week, but it was giving up ground. We had been up around 106 a week and a half ago. We're 104.80 as of this week on the index. So it's had a poor week. And with that, the gold and silver markets have come to life. So at this point, you've got gold at, 23.88, silver at 31.30. So both of those have taken out the last significant resistance level that they had, and looks as though they're going to go up and test the upper ones that we saw back in the a couple of months ago. My long term, or the, you know, when they look at the silver model, the move and breakout that we had back at the end of April in the consolidation for silver, that still measures up to $38, and we're at 31 and change right now. So, you know, the big moves in silver tend to be quite explosive and have a lot of steam behind them at the tail end. So wouldn't be at all surprising to see where we've been putting in higher monthly lows for the last 3 or 4 months now. Wouldn't be at all surprised to see that this gained some momentum. And if it starts to break out, we know how they can squeeze the shorts in the silver market.
What's going on with crude?
Crude rallied stronger than I thought it would. We got up into the $83 range this week. Has retraced a good three quarters of the decline that we had from the high in the first quarter of the year. Seasonally, whatever move you have in June, and in this case it was a pretty good rally from 72.5 here up into the $83 range, you tend to see a setback from there. So looking for not a lot of upside action there. And if I look at the stocks, the XLE and the XCG, as far as the ETFs are concerned, there doesn't seem to be a lot of leadership in there. Speaking of leadership, if we take a look on the precious metals, the GDXJ, the GDX, have been doing very nicely this week. So it's good to see the miners moving with the bullion.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
The short positions in the Canadian dollar are going to start hurting here if we see too much more strength. The Canadian has done reasonably well. Did touch 73.5 this week, had been down around 72.75 a week ago. There's this just huge short position from the small spec positions. We're waiting until Monday before we get an update from the CFTC, but the number of short positions out there is subject to then causing a pretty good short covering move. If we were to go through 73.5, which was the resistance level that we saw in May and June, I think you could see a bit of a spurt. But overall, major trend in the Canadian still is down, but don't be surprised if you get a bit of a pop in the meantime.
What's happening with Bitcoin?
Well, I'm glad that I don't hold any Bitcoin. It has gotten a real roller coaster here this year. You know, we've had this thing, move from the beginning of the year down at 40,000, rallied up until March to 72,000. We got some really good readings up there in terms of exhaustion points. And since then now created a big double top. The first pullback was to 57,000. Then we retested the 72,000 and failed from there. And we're right back down at 57. This is, not a healthy looking market at all. And in terms of where to find support, I think you got to be looking once again, maybe back into the mid 40,000s. So it's not one for the faint of heart by any means. The fluctuations is this historically been big. And once you have these big exhaustion points like we had back in March, it's just not unusual to see big 50 to 70% price corrections.
Russ, how can people take advantage of your special offer?
The website is chartsandmarkets.com, and right there on the front page there is the subscription.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Coming up, Mark Leibovit next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Mark Leibovit, editor and publisher of the Leibovit VR Newsletters, also known as VRTrader.com. He's speaking to us from Arizona. Mark, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Glad to be back. In fact, this week I'm speaking to you from Flagstaff, Arizona, out of Phoenix, because of the ridiculous heat that the Southwest U.S. has been experiencing. And here at 7,000 feet, at least you don't have those extreme numbers. How's the heat holding up in the Vancouver.
Vancouver's going to have a very warm and sunny weekend, so we're finally catching up. Summer's finally arrived.
Okay. Well, you know, Phoenix 110, 115, and
not that.
Vegas and so forth, so it's wild.
Do you have a special offer for our listeners?
Yeah, for new subscribers to VR Trader, I'm still offering the half-off promo. And when you go to VR Trader, you enter 2022 half-off as the promo code. And for any newsletter or group of newsletters or time frame, you get that 50% off, but only for new subscribers.
24-hour stock trading 5 days a week. How could this affect stocks and markets?
Well, you know, this is really exciting stuff. You know, I mean, for traders like myself, we've had 24 hours before now because we've had futures markets that trade overnight. And you have some future stock plays as well. So certain stocks have futures on them individually. So the fact that, you know, Robinhood is creating this 24-hour accessibility, you know, it just an extension of essentially what was going on, the demand worldwide for stock trading, which, as you know, has become hyperbolic here, you know, in terms of activity, particularly with some of the hot AI stocks and so forth. So, yeah, the others will catch up, you know, Schwab and Fidelity and the whole group, I'm sure, at some point. And it just, you know, customer demand. You know, the thing is, things happen overnight or after the market closes, and it's frustrating when you don't have, you know, full liquidity or access to a story. You know, news stories aren't always timed to market hours, and for some reason, some companies or, you know, news sources like to release things after hours, and sometimes even during the middle of the night, things happen overseas or other places. So it would be great to have access. So I think it's a great plus. Essentially, it's an extension, as I said, as was happening anyway, and it helps trading addicts like myself, you know, participate perhaps in times where you may not have been able to.
Can you see a time when there's just one big world stock market instead of these individual markets in Hong Kong, Shanghai, London, New York? Or do we actually have that now?
You know, well, in a way, you know, they all follow each other. I think there's too much independence, you know, among countries and markets and, you know, exchanges for them to suddenly decide. Of course, it could be a slow process, and you could be right. I haven't even thought about that. I mean, it's regional, you know, New York Stock Exchange, it's got its thing. And, you know, even though the regional exchanges work with it, it's still the big brother on the block. And, and in the futures markets, you know, you've got the Chicago Exchange, the Board of Trade, and the Merck, and there's always been competition between that and the COMEX in New York. I remember when my days when in floor trading, when that was going on. So if there's something on the table I don't know about, but I think there's too many regional and country-centered interests that I don't think that's going to happen so fast, but it could happen. You know, I guess it'd be interesting. There'd be one exchange. Of course, they don't have to be open 24 hours like we just discussed, because if you're trading Shanghai and Paris and Liverpool and London, you're going to want to have, you know, one central place and one exchange to be able to do that.
And of course, big stocks like Apple and Amazon, you are trading the world.
Right, but you can't access them only through some brokers overseas overnight. You know, there are some exchange brokerage firms that will allow you to trade Apple overseas at night. I don't have all the details on that, but there is overnight trading going on now at certain hours, but the liquidity level is low because there aren't that many participants. But again, the Robinhood example of expanding the trading hours, I think, is great. If you question how much volume they'll be able to handle and how liquid those markets will be, I mean, if they're opening 24 hours, obviously the others are going to have to join to really, you'll get more access, but how thick that market is going to be and doing size orders is still, it would be in question. So it'll see how it all plays out for small individual investors, you know, for a few hundred or a thousand shares or whatever, it's not going to make a difference. But I don't know if the institutions are going to jump on until they know there's really enough liquidity there.
Well, I know some people who follow the shopping network say, I made some pretty poor choices at 3 a.m. Could the same thing happen with stocks?
Well, it depends whether you're technical or you're using your work. You know, some people just buy the news or sell the news. We'll be coming up to a discussion about that in just a moment on Bitcoin. But suddenly, you know, that would be an issue. But you know, for myself and technical traders, you know, you see the patterns and you know, you react accordingly if there's, you know, certain breakdowns or breakouts and so forth. So it also depends what your sleep schedule is. You know, I mean, some people work at night, sleep in the day. There is trading going on overnight. I mean, it's not like something new. So, and then the question is how the markets react in the morning to the overnight trading. Sometimes overnight trading goes to extremes and it's not necessarily recognized when the markets actually open during normal hours. There are a lot of variables here. I mean, if you've been doing this for years and years, as I have, I mean, there's nothing, no real consistency to it. Part of it is because of a thin market. So that might be alleviated if, you know, the more markets open 24 hours and there's more liquidity there, as I mentioned a moment ago. So, question is, do you sleep well at night or are you up in the middle of the night checking the markets? That's a question.
The Fed is hinting at a future rate cut. Do the fundamentals in the bond market support a rate cut?
Well, the Treasury bonds, you know, are on a different path than the Fed. I mean, the Treasury bonds have been trying to rally here on and off with no great consistency, you know, for quite a few weeks. A few months, actually, and the Fed's not doing anything. You look at the chart, it looks like several failed, optimistic attempts to rally the bond market, anticipating lower rates, and again, the Fed's doing nothing. So, you know, the Fed has no control over the bond market. The bond market is independent, which very few people really understand. It's its own. And, you know, people question, is it the tail wagging the dog type situation with the bonds? And the fact they're trying to rally may have encouraged the Fed to do something in the future. You know, everybody's hoping for September the Fed's going to do something, and we don't know whether it be political or apolitical or not. And so the bonds are trying to tell the Fed, you know, think about it. And the problem in history is that generally when the Fed lowers rates, the stock market goes down. I mean, usually there's some event, and I mentioned this before, maybe this time will be different, that triggers the Fed having to act and react aggressively to offset something. You know, I'm still in the camp that there's going to be a correction coming up here. There's going to be one into the fall, which is traditional anyway. There may be one before that. A lot of people looking for the summer rally, but even the summer rally has a limited time frame, and there could be another black swan event or something happening. In fact, we just saw one in the crypto market. So, there's a lot of stuff going on here. And I guess if there's a big sell-off or some catastrophe or black swan event, and it could be anything. I mean, I could sit here and speculate, and you could for hours about what that could be. We've seen surprises, everything from, banking crises to COVID, you know, so, and Ukraine wars and, just things that come out of the blue, the Israeli-Hamas war situation, which dramatically affected the market short term at the time. So, the question is, what's going to happen between now and then, and what kind of risks you have, and what the Fed might or might not be compelled to do in some extreme situation. So, you know, there could be an event, they lower the rates, but the market goes down anyway because of some other event and may not have the effect that everybody's thinking about. I mean, it's really silly because if you think about it, even though I'm not that bullish on the stock market, even though it's gone up because it's been limited by a handful of stocks and most stocks really haven't participated. So it violates, you know, cardinal rules of technical analysis that go back for decades. You know, so if you don't get confirmation in the Dow Transportation Index or the Russell 2000's not doing well, and 3 or 4 stocks are making the whole stock market, I mean, that's red flags on top of red flags. And yes, you can trade those individual stocks. And yes, I suppose you can hold your breath and your S&P will go up because three or four stocks are driving it up. But ultimately, the truth is going to bear out and there's going to be a collapse because the market can't be held up that way. It hasn't been, for a hundred years that I've looked at data. So, there's trouble coming at some point, maybe they'll try to keep it up. Right after the election into next year with the same or some new president, usually the first few months of a new year with a newly elected president, the markets tend to do better. So there's so many variables here. So, I'm trying to roundabout answer your question. So as far as the Fed's concerned, we'll see what happens. And the bond market's trying to encourage them, but we don't know what the end result will be when they actually do it. Maybe you don't want to get your wish fulfilled. May not be the great scenario considering the market, such as the S&P, has been able to move up even despite the fact the Fed didn't lower rates. And everybody's been talking about lower rates for months, and they were going to lower rates five or six times, and it didn't happen. So it's really crazy. It's like illogical events unfolding. And I guess if you're just a passive long-term investor, you don't care. You just hold an S&P forever and you weather the 20-30% corrections and you just stand aside. That's one way to go. But if you're fine-tuning it the way I do it, looking both at individual stocks and confirmations and non-confirmations and technical readings and divergences and so forth, your head is spinning because there are a lot of things that should be happening that are not happening. So a lot of manipulation going on in the market, and it's really unfortunate because we need new rules are there for a reason. And when they're not being conformed to, that does create problems ultimately for the market.
What's happening with Dr. Copper?
Well, the AI had a positive event effect, I would say, here in a certain extent, because suddenly this great demand for AI required tremendous uses of new electric power. And I know we've been talking about this for months, about the need for the grid, the electric grid, to be improved and expanded because of the demand, supposed demand for electric vehicles. And we just found out about the story about Tesla. We'll talk about that shortly. But so when the AI thing came in, suddenly there's a tremendous demand, and big companies like CEG and so NEE, which are the electric power business, are suddenly getting their stocks rallying up big, and there's tremendous demand for power to run the AI equipment to do all this, AI, computing. So that's put pressure on these companies to expand the grid, which indirectly, I guess, is going to help the EV situation, which had been lagging for a while. So I guess the greed and money being made in AI stocks, and the demand for power has put pressure on the utilities that are in that space. And two companies that are heavily involved in that has put pressure. So the expansion is increasing, and the rate of expansion and demand is increasing for that. So, maybe the time frame for the needed electric grid expansion, which would accommodate both the AI and the EV, has been accelerated a little bit because of this AI demand. So it's been a positive if you're looking for expansion, because money is pushing for that big time, where before with electric vehicles, it wasn't being pushed as much big time. It was being pushed, but the AI demand is so frenetic and so, outlandishly crazy that maybe it'll, and so far there are some indications it's pushing it along. But now, this doesn't mean people are going to run and buy EV vehicles or do more than they might have done anyway, but it might help that situation. But it's certainly directed toward the AI grid needs, which is, as I mentioned, heavily in demand and apparently is being responded to.
Do you think the grid's going to be able to service artificial intelligence and EVs?
Well, that's what they're working on now, supposedly. The pressure is on doing that. I think the end result is it's accelerating the time frame a little bit, unless suddenly AI crashes and people decide AI is hocus pocus and it's not as big and powerful and important as everybody seems to believe it is for the years to come. If that's true, then that could slow down the process. But I think the answer is yes. that so far it's increasing the need for that power, and it's helping both. So that's what I'm hearing. So I'm not in there connecting it or doing it. I'm just reading what I'm hearing is going on. So I guess enough money pushes for it, and the AI demand is so great, and so much money is being pushed into AI and stocks and the technology or the use of it, that that might be the catalyst that was needed to really get that AI get the EV power needed as well. So we'll see. It's interesting. I'm not a big EV proponent. I'm more of a hybrid type person. I don't like to count on one source of energy, and I wish, frankly, geniuses like Elon Musk would come up with alternate energy even above the EV, where you can power your car on fission or fusion energy or solar energy or some other energy, so you're not dependent on the grid altogether. You should have, I think, a vehicle that would have multi sources of power, that you could rely on and not only rely on one or two. So that would be great if that ever happens. But I think if it's going to happen, it would be someone like Elon Musk that would come up with it.
Cars have been invented that run on compressed air, but there's no money in compressed air.
Okay, maybe that's it. No money in it.
What's causing Tesla's sudden upside explosion?
Okay, so what happened this past couple of days, Jim, is the analysts suddenly got excited about the fact that Tesla reported deliveries higher than was expected. So it's really a joke, because the charts were telling you that a big rally was coming and the whole decline was just a corrective event. So we were just waiting for a confirmation. It was what we would call an inverse head and shoulders pattern, and it broke out of that a few days ago. And then the story came out about the deliveries. Now, I don't believe for a moment that information wasn't known ahead of time. And the last thing you want to depend on is fundamental analysts and their revisions on earnings or their price projections, because they tend to follow stuff rather than anticipate it. So, we were long. We bought Tesla. We actually bought the tracking stock, which is TSLL, which tracks the stocks. You don't have to pay $180, $200 a share. And we had some really nice profits in that. And that was based on the technical breakout. And then, the story also hits. And, again, the deliveries is not something that's just a surprise. I mean, everyone knows about what the deliveries are. And suddenly it come out, it was a surprise to analysts. It's really a joke. So this is just a function of Wall Street. This is why I'm a contrarian and a technician to a certain degree, and you see it down. And what I was taught years and years ago in the rules of stock market manipulation, which nobody likes to talk about but exists, is stocks are driven down so the smart money can acquire positions, and it's driven up to unload positions. And I saw this as a floor trader years ago. So if a group wants to acquire it, they hit the bids, they drive it down, trigger stops, they get everybody out of the stock while they're accumulating it, and they do the opposite when they run it up on good news. And it's not 100%, but it's a technique that often occurs. And Tesla was bad-mouthed. He was the worst of the Magnificent Seven. It was driving the market down because of its weighting in the NASDAQ index. And it's so funny, because I'm looking at it and saying, well, when are they going to turn this around and reverse it? And we saw the breakout on the pattern, and this is coming off the low. It was not here at, $250 a share. We saw it at $180. So anyway, it was a story to answer your question. And it's probably an opportunity to sell the stock, honestly, if you're a trader. We did sell. Though big picture, I'm positive on Elon Musk and Tesla and so forth and so on. But remember, the stock was, it's been split several times, and the high, I believe, is around $414 a share, adjusted for the split. Got down to about $150, then rallied, came back down again to $180, and now took off to $250. So it's still well below where the historical highs exist for the stock. And though it may ultimately go through there, don't know when, we're trading it. So that's your answer.
Are you seeing strength in gold?
Short term, we have a reversal pattern off of a trading bottom, and we're long. as a trader. I'm not saying I'm going to be in it, you know, every day next week or every month thereafter. You know, we trade it. My big picture view is still 2,700 plus, but I can also see the possibility of a correction. I mentioned this in the previous interview, possibly back down to 2,000. It could do that, and it has plenty of time to do it between now and the end of the year and then go up again. So in a market that you least expect that type of volatility, as we just saw in Bitcoin, well, again, I keep bringing that up because that's been one of the big stories here, but out of the blue, gold could collapse, sell off, and then go up again. So on a short-term basis, we took off our hedges. We had some bear hedges on the gold, physical gold. There's two ETFs you can use for that. And when a little bottom came, it looked like a little bottom was coming in. We've had a nice rally here for the second day off of a little low, and we'll see how it trades into next week. So as a trader, we're long. And I'm sort of getting the gut feeling that if it runs enough here and if it doesn't really break out, I might want to put those hedges back on again with the possibility of another wave down, you know, a trading wave down before it goes up again. So these are volatile markets, and you just that's how I'm dealing with it. So I guess long term I'm a bull, but I'm trading it, and we'll see how it acts in the next few weeks. Some of the cycle work indicated a high sometime this summer, so maybe this is part of that, and then it goes into a correction again, and then we have another buying opportunity, you know, when it pulls back in the fall or early next year. But the long-termers, my comments are irrelevant if you're, you know, if you've been in it for years. I mean, I've been in it since it was $300-$400 an ounce, trading it in the last 20 years, but I've been in and out of it many times since then because of other capital needs and opportunities along the way. But we have the BRICS nation situation. We've got all kinds of reasons why gold could go up, but we also, you know, we still have manipulation in the gold market. This has been going on for decades. I will keep referring to GATA, GATA.org, an organization that has done all the empirical research on the manipulation by the government and irregularities at the COMEX exchange and all kinds of, you know, all kinds of crazy activities that go on behind the scenes that do affect the market. I mean, frankly, if we didn't have this manipulation, gold would probably already be $10,000 an ounce. So it was suppressed for many reasons. And now the question is, are the forces that are not, that are out there, that are they're not excited about suppressing gold as they were in the past? And this is the big question right now, because it has been suppressed for decades. So the question is now, what's going to happen going forward? And it seems like it broke out a little bit of that pattern when it was able to cross above the 2000 level and get, and, you know, a few months ago. So, you know, maybe the forces that be that are involved that are not as aggressive as they used to be. So I'm always a cautious bull in gold because of the manipulation, but we do trade it. At the moment, we're long, and we'll see how it plays out and whether it breaks out in the next week or so.
Could Bitcoin have put in a double top?
It appears so, because we've already broken quite a bit. 72,000, 73,000 was the top, and I had warned about this in our previous interviews about there was big support in the market, particularly in the 57,000 to 56,000, 57,000 range, and we're there now. And whether you want to say it's broken already, we're sitting right at that 57,000, 56,000 range. And as a result, this is part of my theory that, you know, we could see some volatility there, and that if it doesn't hold here, we're looking possibly into the mid-40s on Bitcoin. But it was triggered supposedly. I mean, it looked like it had topped out, and as you say, a double top, it looked like it had formed, and it was sort of dilly-dallying around a little bit and slowly moving down into the 60s, and suddenly, in the last couple of days, the story hit about Mt. Gox. Now, I don't know if many of the listeners are up to speed on Mt. Gox. I remember when Bitcoin first started to trade, I think it was around, was it 2012 or so? Mt. Gox was one of the only places you could buy Bitcoin, and it was, I believe, a Japanese organization. In any event, they went bust, and was one of the reasons why I didn't trade Bitcoin initially way back then, when it was trading, you know, around 1,200, 1,500, 1,700, because there was some concern about the future of Mt. Gox. So it was like a clearing firm, like Coinbase and others. And apparently all these years later, now bankruptcy courts are involved, and they're trying to, I don't know how they're doing it, but they're trying to restore lost funds. And the lost funds, where they're coming from or how they're doing it, but apparently that's creating selling pressure because they're initiating some type of customer repayments, they call it. And I don't know where they're getting the coins to do this, but that triggered some selling. There was some selling in Germany the last few days or so. There's some press about that. And apparently the Mt. Gox situation, which will be helpful to the people that lost money years ago when they went under, but apparently is putting pressure on the, this is the story. You know, I can't prove this is really true, or they're just using this as the excuse, but they're saying it collapsed because purportedly there's about $9 billion in Bitcoin that has to be, repaid to customers that lost way back in 2014 when the Mt. Gox collapsed. So, I mean, I was always concerned after Mt. Gox. I said, well, how do we know Coinbase or some of the other coin exchanges that are out there, exist? Uphold is another one that I tend to use. They're based overseas. How you know your money is safe and how you know it won't happen again. So that's always supposedly the risk, and that's been the logic behind creating the ETFs. Well, part of the logic for the ETFs recently is because now you can buy an exchange-traded fund, which changes on the exchange, and it's not going to go under so fast, though, of course, it could trade up and down. So you have little so-called safety versus owning or trading the virtual coin, on one of these platforms. But in any event, the long and short, and I'm being long-winded here, it topped out technically. Yes, there was some type of double top formation up there in 72, 73. We've now pulled back into the mid-50s. We'll see if this holds or not. Maybe this is the bad news out of the way, and this is your big buy point. I'm waiting for some, confirmation. It looks like it got overdone here a little bit, but there is still room on the charts that you could see even a break into the mid-40s, possibly. I'm still a bull long term. I'm sure Larry Fink at BlackRock, who created the big ETF, which in a real way triggered this most recent big rally, I'm sure he's not concerned that it's the end of Bitcoin or anything like that. So it's probably a buying opportunity here for those who are not in the market, who would be happy to pay $56,000 for Bitcoin versus $72,000, but with the eye that you could have risk down to the mid-40s. Ultimately, we're probably going to go to 90 to 150 or even higher levels, but I don't have a time frame for that. And a lot will now depend, I suppose, on this Mt. Gox situation, which popped out of the blue. We're truly, the only warning we had was that double top formation.
Is there a crypto crash happening, or is it just Bitcoin?
Yeah, all cryptos are down. XRP is down. Dogecoin, Doge, which was the big one with Elon Musk, that's down. Some of these are down. I don't have the exact percentages here, 20 to 50% sell-offs. Yeah, the trigger was pulled. Bitcoin came in, and the panic ensued. So, XRP was trading in the low 50s, and now it's 39.40 cents, for example. Just another coin. I have to pull them up here on the screen. So there are nice corrections here, and I don't know if crash is the correct word, nice correction for sure. But people who are leveraged in these things, could get caught and could accelerate further. But I'm seeing it as a buying opportunity. I actually traded myself some of these coins in the last 24 hours because of this panic, and I already made some money on them because they bounced a little bit off the lows, going to one of these exchanges. So I jumped in on a couple that were really way down, and you can trade them off your phone, which I enjoy doing because you're talking about trading in the middle of the night. We talked about that a few minutes ago. I actually did a couple trades in the middle of the night when I saw the big break in these trades 24 hours already. So you can do that. In any event, I already stepped in, but I already took a little profit. I just traded it just to see if, just to see if there was possibility of another wave down and another buying opportunity. So I'm watching it really carefully here. But, I love the volatility. That's great. To my knowledge, you can't short these things. You can just buy them, but maybe there's a technique that I don't know about. In any event, when I see over time big shakeouts in a lot of these cryptos, and you look at your charts, see where they've been, and you have some technical analysis training, you can sort of pick out potential buy points and support levels along the way. So had some fun with it myself in just the last 24 hours. But yes, to answer your question, sort of a crash panic underway, and we'll see if it's going to hold here or it's going to find support or not. We just have to watch the tape.
Mark, are you a financial advisor?
No, I am not a financial advisor, or just a newsletter writer, publisher. Thank you. And I don't provide financial advice.
Can you tell us again about your special offer?
At vrtrader.com, at vrvictorrobertrader.com, you can buy any of our newsletters for 50% discount using the promo code 2022, half off, only for new subscribers.
Mark, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Mark Leibovitt, editor and publisher of the Leibovitt VR Newsletters. He was speaking to us from Arizona. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me.
Can you tell us a bit about the Trend Letter?
Sure. We've got four services. We have the Trend Letter. So that started in 2002. So we're, 22nd in the year now. Publishes every Sunday night. Covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. And really, it's a service there that's for people that really want to understand what's driving the markets. So there's that one. We've got Trend Technical Trader, online service. Started as a hedging service, but now it covers pretty much everything. Invests in long positions and also covers many sectors, again, commodities, equities, precious metals. And it has our proprietary gold technical indicator. And the audience here for more active investors, but certainly long-term investors certainly benefit, especially with the hedging strategies. Third one is Trend Disruptors. So that's obviously in the disruptive sectors. Very speculative, so it's only for risk capital. So we're talking about artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, 5G, Internet of Things. So again, very speculative, that's one that you can, you're looking for risk capital that you can afford to lose. The fourth one is our free service, so that's called Headlines. And that's where we go out, check the markets every morning, and then we send out headlines that we think every investor needs to know. And simply people can just either read the headline, or if they want to read about the article, they just click on the link and they get that. So that's those four. If anybody's interested in any of that, just let us know at info@thetrendletter.com, or you can just go to our website, thetrendletter.com, and click on the subscribe button.
The S&P 500 and NASDAQ made new all-time highs this week. What's driving that?
Yeah, it's amazing. Wednesday's close, that was the S&P 500's 32nd all-time high this year. And today, I'm just looking at the market, we're getting close to the close here. It looks like today we're probably going to have a 33rd all-time high. So that's an average of five all-time highs per month. And so what's driving it? Well, you know, you've got, of course, you've got the big tech AI boom. So that's, you know, been led off course by NVIDIA, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Meta. And so, you know, what that has caused is, you know, FOMO, so the fear of missing out. So that's where anybody who doesn't own those stocks feels the pressure that they need to buy. Also, July is typically one of the strongest months for stocks. And then, of course, you know, we've got these, the recent development after the debate where Biden's performance gave Trump a big advantage. And, you know, now we're hearing that the Democrats are seriously looking to replace Biden, which should be interesting. But for investors, so if we take the politics out of it, you know, for investors, Trump is perceived to be business friendly, while Biden and the Democrats are not. So when it looks like Trump might win this election, well, then the market's like that. So that's just another thing feeding into it. And then, you know, we've got about $6 trillion that's sitting in money market funds earning, you know, 4.5%. So if we keep getting these, you know, multi highs per month in the stock market, we're going to see some of that, you know, money market capital flow into the better returns in the stock market, which again is just going to help give a bid to that. Now, on the bearish side, you know, we've got the market is very overvalued and it's overbought. So although July is a strong month, we are seasonally in the very weakest part of the year for stocks from May to October. So that's that mantra, you know, sell in May and go away. We've also got global economies weakening. Of course, we've got Russia, Ukraine, the Middle East wars still kicking, and, you know, any escalation there could be a problem. Another thing that we're keeping our eye on is this insane deficits and debts that all these countries are racking up. Just yesterday in our headline service, we sent out an article from Bloomberg highlighting how the S&P and the Scope rating agencies, they are both sending out severe warnings that these government spending is putting sovereign debt sustainability at real risk here. And I think that, you know, they've been kicking this thing down the road for years and years and years, but these debt problems globally are really going to start to hit, I think. You know, government debt means more and more bonds need to be issued to pay for all that debt, and that's inflationary. But, you know, clearly short term here, the trend is clearly up. At some point, we're going to get a correction, but until we see this tech boom cool off, you do not want to be short the stock market.
NVIDIA had another outside reversal recently. You previously highlighted in March how NVIDIA had an outside reversal and it corrected over 22%. What do you see this time?
Yeah, well, you know, an outside reversal is a good reliable indicator of a trend change. So and a bearish outside reversal is when the stock price for the current day is both higher and lower than the previous day, and then it closes lower than the previous day. Now, I know that sounds like a mouthful, but so the last time NVIDIA had an outside reversal was on March 8th. After that outside reversal, over the next few weeks, as you say, NVIDIA corrected about 22-23%. Now, NVIDIA had been the leader, of course, in that stock market bull market. So whenever you see the leader in a market pull back, you need to take notice. So soon after that event in March, we then had all the major markets experience an outside reversal, which further suggesting that NVIDIA was leading the market higher and lower. So on this now, this recent outside reversal was on June 20th. NVIDIA had peaked at $140.76, and then it closed the day below the previous day low. So again, outside reversal. Since then, NVIDIA has now pulled back about 17%, but it's been rallying now since that low, although it's down about 1% today. So with the market rallying and hitting all these new highs, it does look like that 17% correction may have been the extent of the pullback. So we won't know till we know. So what we're watching here, NVIDIA right now is trading at about $127. That key supports that 70% low was at the $116 level. Now, to break past the recent high, NVIDIA needs to push through that 140.76. So again, there will be a significant correction for NVIDIA and the tech stocks, but until that current trend breaks, you know, tech is still hot.
The U.S. dollar has been running high. What's behind that?
Yeah, well, the thing about currencies is, you know, for all investors, you need to understand that it's all connected. And it's really about the U.S. dollar. So if the U.S. dollar is strong, then that negatively affects most of the other currencies. It affects commodities, equities, and precious metals. And when the U.S. dollar is weak, all those other things tend to rally. So, you know, in the last month or so, we've seen both the Bank of Canada and the ECB cut rates. So now the Fed rate is 5.5%. Bank of Canada is 4.75%. So the value of the Canadian dollar declines versus the U.S. dollar because the U.S. is a higher rate. You get a better return. Now, the same thing for the ECB. The rate there is even lower. So there's only 4.25%. So the euro has also been declining against the U.S. dollar. Now, this week, things have changed where we're seeing the U.S. dollar has actually declined. And then all those other currencies, you know, the Canadian, the euro, and the pound, they've all been rising. So then the question is, well, you know, why is the U.S. declining? Why is the U.S. dollar declining? And it's, you know, basically we're getting weaker U.S. economic data. Although today they had the headline jobs data came out, which was stronger than expected, but it's very interesting. So that's what everybody reported, but they also did all their usual revisions. And if you take the revisions into effect, then the data is actually weaker. I mean, this data gets so manipulated. I really don't put much faith in it, but you know, the markets do. So we need to keep an eye on it. So overall, the general weaker economic data, that's telling the markets are forecasting a 71% chance that the Fed's going to cut rates in September. So that is now putting pressure on the U.S. dollar. Also, you know, the market knows that Trump, now, you know, again, based on the debate, people are starting to assume Trump's probably going to win the election. Well, he's made it very clear he wants lower rates and a lower U.S. dollar. So I think that's just another element that's putting pressure on the U.S. dollar. Now, longer term, you know, we expect that the U.S. economy is going to remain stronger than most others, and that means the U.S. dollar is going to remain stronger than most others. And it's not like we like the U.S. dollar per se. It just is it's going to be, you know, that least ugly house on the block. It's, of all the currencies, it would be the strongest. So it's so important, you know, for your listeners, to all investors, to understand how all these things are connected. Near-term resistance for the U.S. dollar is $5.75. Today it's about $5, and near-term support is about 102.
How about the Canadian dollar?
Well, for the Canadian, it's a bit of a mixed bag here. You know, it had been struggling, but again, it gained this week, just as the other ones have because of the U.S. dollar weakness. But it's also, we need to understand that there's been a huge short position on the Canadian dollar, like historic. And as the Canadian dollar starts to rise because the U.S. dollar declined, those people holding those short positions, well, they need to start buying the Canadian dollar in order to cover the short position. And then that puts a bid under the Canadian. So that just adds and magnifies the Canadian dollar rally. But I see this rally in the Canadian to be very temporary. You know, currently the Canadian's at about 73.45. Key resistance is at 73.60. So it's getting very close to that. Near-term support would be 72.50. Jim, you know, I suspect that we're going to see the Canadian dollar hit 70 and even lower in the next year. Now, this could be good news to some areas. I mean, obviously, it's not good news for importers and consumers, but for exporters and for people that are looking to invest in resource stocks, I think the Canadian producers are going to do very well. You know, their costs are in Canadian, but their revenue is in the U.S. dollar. So I'm talking about things like oil, natural gas, uranium, copper, gold, silver. They are all priced in U.S. dollar, and yet they're all, the costs for those producers are in the Canadian. You know, for oil, if we look at oil, you know, we have that new pipeline expansion. So that's now reducing the discount Canadian producers are receiving. So they're getting more of the money for the exports. And with oil likely going to $100 or higher, and the Canadian dollar likely heading to 70 cents or even lower, I think these Canadian producers are going to make a killing.
You often say that the euro has a near-perfect inverse relationship to the U.S. dollar. Why did the euro rise this week?
Yeah, well, up to this week, I mean, the euro has been struggling, you know, mainly recently due to the election in France, which actually, I think that ends on this Sunday night. So there's real concern there of violence and civil unrest. I just read yesterday that the police, they've deployed 30,000 police for Sunday night to ensure, as the police statement said, to ensure the radical right and the radical left do not take advantage of the situation and cause mayhem. You know, that's the French election. I think we're going to be hearing a lot of similar warnings when we get into the U.S. election. And then remember, you know, the Olympics start in Paris in about 3 weeks. So again, you could see some more unrest there. But the balance in the, for the euro this week is really all about the U.S. dollar again. You know, as I just mentioned, you know, the recent economic data has been suggesting the U.S. economy is slowing. That opens the door for the Fed to cut rates in September. So, you know, that hits on the dollar. I also think that with all the turmoil in the U.S., especially after the debate, questions about whether Biden should step down, investors are not comfortable with what's going on, all this uncertainty. So one thing that, and one thing that's really clear from the debate to me is that neither Biden or Trump are at all interested in reducing spending and lowering the debt. So that means more debt, and more debt is inflationary. So all of that to me is just why the euro's, you know, been picking up. But the reason the euro's been picking up is primarily because the U.S. dollar's been going down.
Bitcoin's been dropping and was below 58,000. What's going on there?
Well, you know, first of all, I guess, you know, Bitcoin and all these cryptos, they've been incredibly volatile. So, you know, if we go from September to March, Bitcoin went from just over 25,000 in September to just under 73,000 in March. I mean, that's an increase of about 182% in less than 6 months. And then since that high, Bitcoin's been trading in kind of in a nice solid range between 62,000 and 72,000. So now it's fallen below that, you know, so that 62,000 support level. And today, I'm just looking right now, it's 56,500. So it's down about 23% from that March high. So again, tons of volatility here. Now, typically, Bitcoin moves quite similar to gold, you know, affected by interest rates and inflation. Also can be a safe haven play, you know, for those geopolitical concerns. But this recent sell-off here is really specific to Bitcoin and the crypto sector. You know, the crypto market in the last few days lost over $170 billion. But that sell-off primarily came because wallets belonging to this defunct crypto exchange, what's called Mt. Gox, I think it was. So it's been showing signs of moving billions of Bitcoin, and apparently it's all part of a repayment plan to creditors. And then on the same time, you have the German Federated, the Criminal Police Office. They sold off over 175 million of crypto that they've seized from some movie piracy operation. So those two events, you know, that's caused investors to worry that we're going to have a bunch more crypto come onto the market. And so that spooked the crypto market. But, you know, up to now, buying the dips has always paid off with Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is very oversold now. So we're watching this action. We're looking for a low to set in. And I think we're going to see a really nice buying opportunity here. I think Bitcoin is going to continue to be volatile, but ultimately, I think you're going to do very well for the people that get in after these big dips.
You've been very bullish on uranium. It's had a big run over the last couple of years, but year to date, uranium spot price is trending lower. What's your take on uranium going forward?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, you know, uranium's had a great run over the last few years and, you know, a much less inspiring performance year to date. I mean, I think the main reason for this recent weakness is concern of a global recession. You know, so, you know, while it's true that energy use dips in a recession, you know, that temporary loss of power requirement tends to be, you know, quite small and fairly short-lived. I mean, people need to turn the lights on. Longer term, you know, world demand for energy is not going lower. It's going much higher. You know, we've got people in emerging countries. You know, they are very interested in living a much better material life. And that certainly means more energy use. You know, You know, we got over a billion people in the world that still do not have electricity. You know, China and India alone have almost 3 billion people of the 8 billion on the planet, and they are ramping up their demand for power. You know, AI, you know, it's all the rage, but it requires massive new data centers, and they need reliable power. You know, NVIDIA, the big sweetheart of the tech boom, well, its new GPI or GPUs, I mean, they have significant power requirements. So, you know, intermittent wind and sun are not going to cut it. You know, these data centers need continuous power. And then, of course, you know, you've got this global drive to push everybody into an EV. Well, all those electric vehicles, they need to plug in every night. And that's going to be, again, another big demand for the baseload generation of capacity. So we know that the need for more and more power is real. So then the question comes up, well, where does it come from? So you've got the green movement. You know, they want to cut out the use of carbon-based sources. So we're talking oil, natural gas, and coal. And we've got, you know, so now you've got windmills and solar farms. Well, they can certainly supplement the grid, but they aren't a useful base load generation. So it really gets down to, you know, that nuclear is really the only source that's clean, reliable, and stable, and it runs 24/7, whether it's sunny or not, whether it's windy or not. So if you look at the number of plants currently, so there's currently 436 plants in operation. There's, I think, 60 currently under construction, and there's another 110 plants. And I know a couple months ago, I know we were talking on the COP conference. You know, we had 20 countries, so including Canada, France, the U.S., the U.K., they made this commitment, and they called it the Declaration to Triple Nuclear Energy. Well, we've got 436 plants today. If you're going to triple it, that's going to take you up to, you know, over 1,300. You got 60 under construction, you got 110 planned. Well, you would need the equivalent of over 700 more nuclear plants. And, you know, that's a lot of nuclear power. And until fusion energy becomes viable, there will be a need for a lot of uranium to fuel these plants. You know, nuclear plants are really expensive to build, but the uranium fuel cost is a tiny percentage of the actual total operating cost of the plant. So it doesn't really matter how much uranium costs. These plants need it, and they'll buy it. They're going to use it. So has the price declined? Yes, it has. Again, I think it's because of this worry about our short-term recession. But again, and this is all part of that supply-demand price cycle. You know, the price got out of hand. It's correcting. That's what that price cycle does. So for your listeners who are not yet in the uranium stocks, you know, you want to look at dips like this as giving you a great buying opportunity.
What do you see ahead for crude?
Well, some conflicting scenarios, really. You know, oil right now it's trading at $83.50, so it's down about 60 cents today. Short-term bullish side for pricing, you've got that continued tensions in the Middle East. In June, we just saw an increase in the attacks on commercial shipping to be the highest in the year. So, you know, there were, 16 attacks and one ship sunk. I mean, only December of last year had more attacks. So that's been escalating. We're seeing hedge and commodity funds loading up on long positions. Of course, you've got the Ukraine. You know, they've been attacking the Russian refineries. We've got the hurricane season starting. That's going to shut down, you know, 15-20% of the U.S. drilling offshore. And then on the short-term bearish side, you know, we've got weakening economies in many of the developed countries, including Canada and the U.S. We're seeing Russia increasing their production as they need to fund their war with Ukraine. And then you got July, which is typically a weak seasonal period for oil. Now, if we look longer term, of course, so again, demand. You know, we just talked about the growing demand for electricity and energy, especially in those emerging countries. So that's still real. There's over a billion people without electricity in the world. So that's real. Now, the International Energy Agency, they say that India is going to overtake China in the next 2 years to become the biggest driver, for demand for oil. We keep hearing the COP28 crowd and governments telling us we don't need oil, because we're all going to switch to EVs and it'll all go away. But again, you know, they keep seeming to forget that oil is such a key component of all these other parts of our life. You know, your clothing, your smartphone, construction material, computer, shoes, medical supplies, you know, tires for those EV cars, the asphalt roads that these EVs are going to be driving on, all those things need oil. So these are things that people in emerging countries are going to want and need. And so the demand for oil is not going away. And then if you look at supply, again, you know, the whole investment, capital expenditures in that sector are down 30-year lows. You got rig counts continue to decline. And you've got, and why is that? I mean, you've got the COP28 group. You've got governments globally been telling us we don't need or want fossil fuels. Again, they seem to forget that their phones and their clothes and their EVs still need oil product. So, you know, what have they done? They've increased windfall taxes. They've increased regulation. They have allowed no new permitting. No, you combine all that. Again, it's that simple case of supply and demand. You've got an increase in demand. You've got this global concerted effort to squeeze supply, and you're going to result in a serious supply problem over the next few years. So I think we're going to see $100 oil for sure, and likely 150 or even higher.
The last couple of times you're on, you projected gold could surpass $3,000 in the next year. Do you still see that?
Yeah, well, you know, gold's up, what, 14%, I think, year to date. You know, it peaked about $2,440 in May, and then it's been consolidating ever since, trading between $2,300 and $2,400. Well, currently, right today, it's hit $2,400, so it's up about $31 today. That's its resistance level. So we'll see if that punches through. So big picture, you know, there's a new awareness out there. Things have changed. You know, ever since, Russia invaded Ukraine and then the U.S. and the West confiscated Russian assets, that sent a pretty clear message to countries that are not friends of the West. So we're talking countries that don't trust the West, such as China, you know, Russia, Iran, et cetera. And so what they've been doing, they've been loading up on gold. You know, China has been the second largest foreign holder of U.S. debt behind Japan. And, you know, according to the U.S. Treasury, China's been selling off U.S. bonds quite significantly. They sold off about $53 billion in the first quarter of this year. And over the last couple of years, they've sold over $300 billion. So you've got China now being one of the largest buyers of gold, along with Russia, Turkey, India. So gold's in this new territory now, and there's really, to me, there's no real, right now, defined serious technical resistance. I think gold's just starting to catch people's attention. It would only take a small incremental increase in the average person's portfolio to send gold much higher. And then, I mean, then there's the institutional investor. So I think once we see gold, if it pushes to a new high, I think you're going to see a lot of institutional money to come into it. Gold action, you know, it's suggesting that investors have finally figured out that these massive debts and deficits that the U.S. and most of the developed countries' governments have been racking up, that's inflationary, and it reduces the purchasing power of all those currencies. So you want to be a buyer on any serious correction in gold. Again, watch the $2,300 level for support. As I say, gold is right now testing its resistance at $2,400. So back to your question, yeah, I do think we're going to see gold over 3,000 in the next year.
Martin, again, where can people follow you and subscribe to the Trend Letter?
Yeah, well, just, again, go to the Trend Letter. So it's all one word, thetrendletter.com. Click on the subscribe button. There's a couple buttons there you can hit. And if your subscribers or your listeners have any questions about our services or just even what's going on in the market, you can just simply send an email to info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me and have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Mark Leibovit, and Martin Straith. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in 1 week.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.